So the talk with Tom Wright, and yeah, we were the lecturers for that day for a group of pastors. But interestingly enough, Anthony Flew, the ex-atheist who has been in the news so much lately, he heard about this and wanted to join us. And they actually brought him over for half a day, so he did a Q&A session with Tom and myself, and that was at Westminster Chapel in London. So, yeah, all together we had just a wonderful time, and I can't even imagine the amount of planning that had to go into it. All I had to do was fly in and speak and fly out. But, I mean, every night we had something. I mean, I think a typical night was to get to bed by midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning and then have a 7:30 breakfast the next morning, or go. We had one morning where we had to be at the BBC by that time. But I hope it was a very productive tour. But all the credit goes to Peter Luce. Peter Luce and Peter May in particular, they did a great job putting this thing together.
Sure. And you think people are still hungry to hear the kind of arguments that you were bringing?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, Justin. Everybody was warning me, the British folks who were involved in this tour and others besides the two Peters, they're telling me how secular Britain is and how much they're, you know, it's not like, don't expect it to be like the U.S. and don't this and don't that. And I've been in the U.K. a lot, and or a fair amount at least. And you know, I was kind of familiar with that, but I'd say in a couple of venues I was at in universities, I sensed the crowd was largely opposed to what I was doing. And then that became obvious when a couple of the questioners asked some, you know, some of the, I'm trying to be kind here, but some of the questions they asked were very, I don't want to say nasty, but some of the questions were rather, let's put it this way, they weren't on topic.
Okay.
They were addressed to other things that were, you know, what's your Christian's problem kind of questions.
Sure.
But there are a lot of other places. I will tell you this, the churches I was in, I saw a vibrancy in some of the British churches. I'd say virtually every British church I was in, and that's probably a half dozen for that tour. I don't see that vibrancy in this country. So the excitement among the believers was just incredible. We just loved to be among my wife and I. Just loved to be among the folks while they were worshiping, and some of the fellows on the tour, I might say, we gained another traveler and professor from Cambridge and others who would travel with us. They were of the opinion that some things are going on in the UK, and I don't know much about that. But so anyway, you had this kind of mixed bag. You had the people who are really kind of, you know, not happy with what you're doing, and you had the exuberant believers, and
yeah,
it was a great trip.
I'm intrigued by the Anthony Flew area, because this has been, you know, showing up certainly on my radar quite a bit in the last year or so. What kind of a conversation did you actually have with him on that tour? Were you discussing his well, you know, I wouldn't say conversion, but at least his change of mind from atheism to something akin to deism? Many people have suggested, you know, he's getting on in years and his mind isn't all that it was. And so they've somehow suggested that he's not really competent to be a voice now in this sort of debate.
Well, all they've got to do is first of all talk to him and say something like Richard Dawkins doesn't think much of you, or say something like this or that against a religion or something, and just watch him. Just watch him talk, and they can make their mind up if he's senile. I do know that I was teasing with Tony. Tony and I have been friends for more than 20 years. And when we were in the interview, Tom Wright and Tony and myself, I kept teasing him over and over again out loud with the group. And I kept saying, when he'd give this critique or he'd go off on Dawkins, or he gave a impassioned critique of Dawkins, and I would say, yeah, Tony, you sound senile to me. Because this New York Times article had come out a few months before that, trying to portray him that way, trying to portray him as senile and so on. So we kept teasing about this. Yeah, it doesn't sound to me like you can think through these things. And And I did that several times. He just laughed and went right on. And you know, he's got some great things to say. And I, in particular, I would just maybe answer that question by saying, if you know, it's 2008. If people are concerned with you know, that he's been lately he's this way or that way, which is what some of these folks have said. His conversion, quote unquote, which is what I call it, but his conversion goes back to 04, and he will tell you that he was thinking along these lines for about 15 years. So he's got various publications, and he'll tell you where they are. He'll tell you which ones they are. For example, as I recall, an article published in a philosophy journal back about 1990, where he criticizes some secular philosophies to which he used to hold at various points, and he walked away from philosophical determinism years ago. And so if they just watch his career, they can see, to me, it looks a lot more like a change that's come slowly and thoughtfully. I mean, probably, Justin, I doubt anybody in history has published more pro-atheism material than Anthony Flew, at least philosophically. And from a scholar, I would think he's the foremost guy. And as he starts dismantling that for 20 years, such as, you know, I'm not a determinist or I'm open to this, he told me in our first debate in 1985 that he was open to the resurrection. And I said, nah, you're not open. And he'd say, no, I am. I am open. And I think he was rethinking things all the way back in 1985. And one more thing. In our country, there was a joke that was going around. It was told by a comedian. And he said something like, hey, have you heard about this elderly atheist who became a theist? He said, and the joke was something like, well, I'd do that too if I thought I was going to die pretty soon.
Sure.
Well, the joke kind of is on the guy who tells it, because Anthony Flew does not believe in an afterlife. Fervently, as he says over and over, he fervently hopes there's no afterlife. He wants to be dead, and that's it. So it's not a case of hedging his bets in some Pascalian way or something like that.
Well, absolutely. And that's the thing, is that, as much as we refer to it as a conversion, he certainly isn't convinced of the Christian story. But,
no.
But you've obviously engaged him as far back as you say, 1985, I think, was
right.
Your first meeting with him on
right.
On the topic of the resurrection. And I guess you were then, and as you have since, you were bringing forward what you call the minimal facts approach
right.
To the resurrection. So tell us about this and how you came to this conclusion about a particular way of seeing the evidence for the resurrection.
Well, I started writing on my dissertation back probably 1974, and as I said earlier in the interview, finished it in 76. And as I was reading the scholars who were interacting with the resurrection, I'll just say parenthetically here, or as a footnote, the resurrection scene has changed drastically in 30 years. But as I was reading the people who were writing on the subject in the 70s, Rudolf Bultmann's influence was still huge, and you couldn't find very many non-evangelicals or a few moderates, but you couldn't find a whole lot of people who were outspoken in favor of the resurrection. And if you found a chapter here and a chapter there, that would be a lot. But what I noticed is that the skeptics and the critics, nobody would make the move that evangelicals frequently make, which is to argue that the entire New Testament is reliable or somehow trustworthy, let alone that it was inspired. Nobody would make that move in the discussions. But you know, that wouldn't be their starting point, whatever they believed. But these people would not say, this must have happened because it's in the New Testament, the New Testament's reliable. Rather, I noticed that they argued for particular facts and left the rest of it open. They would leave the rest of the issue open and not answer the particular question. So what I did was I noted their methodology, and I thought, okay, if I use your methodology only, and I will only start with data that the critical community agrees is historical. Now, you know, could I still get the resurrection? Now, when I use that sentence, if I only use material that the critical community agrees is historical, could I get to the resurrection? There's two things here. I develop what I call a minimal facts historical method. So it's a method that's important, but it has two criterion, and these two criteria are, the first one, and by far the most important one, is I will only use data that are multiply attested on critical grounds. In other words, I'll only allow facts to count when I have several ways to come at those facts and they all look pretty good. My second criteria that's assumed in that sentence is that most of the critics are on board with these data. So I have the first one's most important, because somebody will say to me, well, how do you know where most critics are? Well, that question's easy, because I'm probably the only guy on the earth that's counted where scholars are. And now, I've done it a lot before 1975, but in particular, I started doing a survey of from 1975 to the present, where are critical scholars on the resurrection? And I have well over 100, probably 140 sub-areas. Now, who would think there are 140 key critical questions, starting from the death, burial, and resurrection, and the appearances of Jesus? But there's 140 issues, and I would track where scholars are. So if they said to me, how do you know where people are? I'd say, I counted the major guys who are doing this, and a lot of the minor ones. So then they'd say, well, how do you know scholarship won't change? Well, it might, but that's why the most important thing is the first criterion, which says I accept these facts because there's multiple reasons for each. That's going to stay the same unless we come up with something different. And as I said earlier, I'd have to pay attention to something if somebody came up with a counter move. So anyway, that's what I call the minimal facts, that I will use the data that skeptics are pleased to use, or that the majority of skeptics, and I say majority, I'm saying that I don't use very much data that are not in the 90-some percentile of accepted facts.
So this is a theory which, in a sense, you have gone to the critics and you said,
right,
I understand where you're coming from, and I'm going to do my, I'm going to, you know, justify the resurrection on your terms. I'm going to use your data. I'm going to say, yeah, okay, well, let's dispense with the bits which maybe, you know, you say only evangelical scholars are prepared to say happened. I mean, what kind of things are we talking about here? Can you give us an idea of any of these facts that you sort of have to take as a base, if you like, to start discussing?
And let me say first, Justin, that I try to out-skeptic the skeptics on this. I will use less data than they will concede.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll, one other personal biographical note to what you were asking me earlier. It's very easy for me to think this way, because during my 10 years of skepticism, I didn't accept pieces of data that where the grounding is, well, you know, the New Testament's inspired, or, well, you know, the New Testament's reliable. I would never accept a fact that relies on that. Even myself, I'd have to say, well, what if reliability is false? What if, you know, and you know, reliable documents can still have problems here and there. Mm-hmm. The library's full of reliable books that have issues. So I could think very, very easily and go that way. But yeah, my point, you're right. My point was that on conservative data, on a conservative read of the New Testament, the resurrection happened. On a moderate read of the New Testament, I have plenty of data to say the resurrection happened. But on a liberal read, I still have plenty of data. So what I would do is I would say, hey, look, Bultmann might give me 20 different things, different facts. I don't need 20. Let's do a dozen. So in some of my books, I'll talk about a dozen. Then I reduce the dozen to, depends on what mood I'm in, because nobody goes to this low. But then I'll go to 4, 5, 6, 7 things. Now, the things I would use, if you said, all right, give me some of those half dozen, I would say we start with Jesus' death by crucifixion, with all the reasons we have, not just that crucifixion killed, but that Jesus was crucified. And virtually nobody questions that today. In fact, John Dominic Cross and Marcus Borg, two of the best-known skeptics today, interestingly enough, both living in this country, but Borg with a DPhil from Oxford and Cross of Irish background. Mm. But both of these two gentlemen, they have comments something to the effect of the fact that the crucifixion of Jesus is the best established fact in the ancient world. It ought not be questioned.
Mm.
In fact, one of them says, "I take it absolutely for granted." So,
I mean, in some ways, the only people I've met who on this program who seriously question it are Muslims, who obviously have a reason to do that from their own scripture.
Right, and the issue with that, to me, is I just had a very kind, gentle dialogue with a Muslim theologian while I was in the UK, and he was just, he was unbelievable. He said, "Hey, look," he said, "I believe this because the Quran says so." And he said, "I don't have independent reasons for saying that's true, but you can understand that I'm committed to it because I'm a Muslim," and that's entirely understandable. But he wasn't trying to do historical apologetics for it.
Mm.
So people can believe what they want to, but my question was, you know, your document 600 years after the New Testament, what can you make out of that on grounds to establish this? And he basically said, "Well, I believe it." And I said, "Well, that's fine. If you want to bring it in as a faith assertion, that's your business. That's fine. A lot of Christians do that, as you know. But I just can't go there personally. I can't say with my fellow Christians, it's true because I believe it. I personally would never make that comment, even though I know a lot of Christians think that."